My guest today is Mary Jo Sharp. She is the founder and director of Confident Christianity. She's written an excellent Bible study called Why Do You Believe That? She's written several books, and her latest book we're going to discuss today. She's also an assistant professor of apologetics at Houston Baptist University. And that's my alma mater, so I'm really, really proud of Houston Baptist, everything we got going on over there. It's an excellent apologetics program. There's just so much that you can connect with, so many great professors there. We've had a couple of professors from the school on our podcast, but they have some really great things going on at HBU. So definitely, if you're interested in these conversations and this is something you'd like to go to school for or study or examine a little further, I strongly suggest you check out HBU, check out the apologetics program over there, and there's great people there just like Mary Jo Sharp teaching, so it's a good thing to check out. Hey, thanks for coming on the podcast today. I'm glad to have you on.
Hey, so good to be on. Thank you.
So how are things going since the launch of the new book?
They've been a bit crazy. There's been a lot of good response to this book in that, I didn't intend for it to be sort of the voice of deconstruction, but not deconversion in the sea of deconversion stories. But it ended up doing that. It ended up like kind of hitting right at the right moment in time where it was a different take on a person who deconstructs their faith, but then doesn't end up deconverting. So that was really, really cool that that happened.
Right. You know, we're going to talk a lot about some of the chapters in the book, but I guess we could kick things off with the motivation or the driving force behind you sharing your personal story, because I know you've written some Bible studies and some excellent teaching tools, but this is your personal story. So you're putting a lot out there, putting a lot on the line, and you're sharing your personal story with someone. So was there any particular driving inspiration for that, or what was kind of the overall goal of writing this book?
I like the sort of the motivation or the driving inspiration. The funny thing is, this is like the story of my life. I was actually approached to do it. That was the driving motivation. I would not have just done it on my own. Like, hey, I really want to share deeply personal stories about how I got hurt in the church when I'm an apologist, right? And a professor. So a lot of the motivation came from somebody just seeing the need for an apologetics or a narrative style apologetics book from specifically, we didn't have that one done by a female or have a female voice. So that was what, I was approached to do this. And that's kind of why we ended up starting on this journey. In fact, I actually resisted it at the start by saying, that's really personal. And I really don't like that idea of sharing into my personal life. And the other thing was I had never written a narrative style before. So I was really concerned about my ability to do so. I was a little nervous about that because I had written mostly just what I would call a lecture style or a lecture format. I began to see more and more stories in the news about believers who deconstructed their faith, as we were talking about, and sharing their own personal stories, but they were ending in that deconversion. And so I thought, I understood that there was a time and place for this book, and it was now. And that, along with the rise of the objection to belief in God based in the hypocrisy of believers, and that was exactly what I had dealt with, those two things really kind of pushed me into saying, yeah, I really do need to carry on and write this, and I really do need to try to do this personal style, because people, they connect to you a little bit better when they hear, something of your heart. And I hope the personal style would make apologetics a bit more approachable to people who may not have known what it is or what it was about, or it sounded really high and lofty. And I was like, no, this is really just about the search for answers to your doubt.
Right. I just reading through it, it communicates apologetics. There's still some teaching in the book, but reading from it as a narrative or a story of your journey into apologetics and into the church, and then reconciling some of the things that you experienced early on, it affected me as already a believer, and I think it would also have a great effect on someone who's a non-believer. Your background is that you grew up in Portland, Oregon, and so I'm from the Bible Belt South. I grew up in church, but reading from the perspective of someone who had a different experience, I thought that was really interesting and unique. So I wonder if you could, as we go into the book, but maybe share a little bit of your story about how you came to faith and what was life before your conversion to Christianity.
Sure, thank you for asking me that. I did grow up outside of church. My parents had stopped going to church when I was too young to remember. I think I was either 2 or 4 or something like that. So I really didn't grow up in the church. And I also grew up in a culture that's somewhat post-Christian, if not very post-Christian. And I think that people don't know that. You know, they talk about the Bible Belt versus the rest of the country, but I don't think they really realize how very post-Christian it was. In fact, I didn't really know anything about Christianity other than what I saw on TV and the movies. And that's what I'm talking about. It's culturally very different. Not everybody's, you know, dad was a preacher or uncle, or they, you know, they grew up going to church, and, you know, it's just a different feel. So, that was a big part of my background. It was just, I felt like as a person who didn't have religion, that I was the normative person in the world, you know, that religion was sort of a fringe thing. But what I did have, conversely, was I had parents who taught me a love of nature and of science and the arts. My dad was a huge cosmology fan. He loved Carl Sagan. He used to watch, he also loved biology. We watched so many nature shows. And he was a musician as well. So I really started to see the great beauty in all these things. And I began to wonder in awe at, what is this all for? Especially in music. I played saxophone. I still play saxophone, actually, but I played in the high school. I had a really good high school band. We played some incredible works of art. And I remember wondering in a moment where I'm in the, you know, inside of this performance thinking, what is this all for? Like, what is this pointing us to? What is this moment of beauty for? And I didn't have an answer to the meaning behind all of this. So I began to be very impressed by what I saw in nature and in the world. Now, I wouldn't have framed it that way because I was a teenager, but that's, I was being drawn to, like, what is the meaning of this? I could have said that. And I had a high school band director who was a Christian, who was burdened for me, but had never shared his faith with anyone before. And he decided to take a risk and share his faith with me. And he did so by giving me a Bible my senior year of high school and saying, when you go off to college, you're going to have hard questions. I hope you'll turn to this. Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to study to be a music director like he was because of my respect for how he taught students to love music. So he was a big influence in my life. And so I began to read that Bible. And eventually I did go off to college, but I did the opposite thing, right? I went off to college and began to explore what the Bible was saying. What does this mean? Is this for real? What do I do with this? And so I started going to church for the first time on my own. And I eventually ended up at a church where I heard a clear explanation of the gospel. And it made sense with all of these other pieces that I had been thinking about. It made sense of the goodness I saw in the world and the beauty I saw in the world. And it brought it all together for me. And I trusted in Jesus for my salvation.
Wow. You know, it's just a good story. Just, I was really moved by that and reading through. I'm a musician and I have friends who play music, so I could have a lot of respect for the things that you saw in art and in culture and in those things that actually pointed you to Christ. And, you know, one of my experiences has been a lot of times you start talking about the culture, and if it's secular, the church will give you some pushback against that instead of seeing the good, even in the secular things that are out there, even seeing the beauty that's in things that maybe aren't quote unquote Christian. And so you had these early on experiences as both a youth leader and working on your husband was a music leader. And so you guys had some interesting interactions, to say the least, with church people early on. It led to some wounds and some heartache. You know, there were some things that were said that were, you know, hard on you guys, and especially you as a new Christian coming into the church. running up against some of the hurtful comments and things that you ran into. And you wrote this in the book, and I thought this was such a good quote. You said, "My distrust in people had produced distrust in the person of God, a relational doubt." So I wonder for those, there are so many Christians in a similar position where they've heard hurtful things from other Christians, or maybe they're new to the church and they don't understand some of the focus of Christians. And so I wonder how your loss of trust in other Christians impacted your view of God at the time, and how you could expound on that just a minute.
Yeah. Well, I think, first of all, I think this is a great question, because it's kind of the unstated thing that's going on a lot of times in deconversion stories, or at least it's a part of it. And I think in some way, this experience, the hurtful experiences in the church, really made me distrust the whole endeavor of Christianity. So after so many hurtful experiences with the people who proclaim that there is now no condemnation in Christ, you know, and I'm experiencing condemnation over and over, I began to wonder if people really trusted in God, or if this was just maybe a pretense for socializing or for remaining in the comfort of a Christian-shaped lifestyle box that they had gotten familiar with. And so I didn't really stop to think about how my hurtful experiences made me think about God himself. Like, I didn't really process that for a while. But in looking back, I can see I was not just becoming skeptical, but I was becoming rather cynical. And I think that's an important point. I was becoming cynical. And I began to wonder, had I been duped? Maybe there's no God and I just needed something psychologically satiating in my life, you know, at the time I became a believer. I began to question everything I thought I knew about God. And what I realized was I couldn't answer the basics, like, why did I think God exists? And why did I think Jesus rose from the dead? And would my answers be any different from anybody of another belief system? And I realized that they wouldn't. So the impact it made on me was I began to distrust God and his existence based in the distrust, the growing distrust in me of people in the church.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of people in that position, and so one of the more, I guess, probably vulnerable things that you had to share was the people close to you and how you they kind of uplifted you and walked with you through all this. And I really got a lot out of reading the dialogue between you and your husband Roger. I enjoyed that. There was a lot of it was funny, and a lot of it was very, very relatable. For anyone who's married out there, going through difficult seasons, sometimes just having that person in the trenches with you can be a blessing. It can be frustrating at times, and sometimes those people get the end of our frustration, you know. And so I wonder, how important was it for you to have someone, quote unquote, in the trenches with you during those frustrating moments, and how did that, you know, help you to get through, and how'd you navigate those frustrating seasons with someone so close to you?
Yeah, those were fun stories, weren't they? in the book, there's a lot of that was kind of, it was fun and not fun to write all at the same time, because my husband Roger and I had to go back through all these hurtful experiences and wade through what would be profitable for the book and what wouldn't. But I do think having someone with you who can see things from a different perspective is always a good check on your thoughts, always. And that was what Roger offered in this scenario. A lot of times where I was being uncharitable or naive in my view, he was the check on that. And, you know, even the scripture in Proverbs 18:17 says that the first person to state their case seems right until another comes along and cross-examines them, right? So that's one of those, like, you need to check on these things that you're saying and believing, because we're all prone to faulty thinking. And when, especially when emotions and desires get involved, and we can really lose sight of any sense of objectivity. C.S. Lewis, I'm going to be paraphrasing him, but he has this idea that reason, unassisted by grace, he says, has a snowflake's chance in a blast furnace to hold on to truths already gained. So even if you've already gained these propositional truths and you have committed to that this is probably true, you can, due to hurtful experiences or emotional experiences or even your own desires, you can melt away those truths. And so, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm denigrating the emotions or desires, but all these things need accountability as well as our reason and rationality. And so it's always a good idea to find someone who can aptly challenge your thoughts. And that means somebody that you do respect. And in my case, my husband he's theologically trained. He has a doctorate in spiritual formation, and he was challenging me all along the way. And we try to bring that out in fun stories and in the some fun and then some really just tense moments throughout the book.
Yeah. You know, that's one of those things I really appreciated about the book was just reading those stories, reading, sort of that narrative. And I just enjoyed it. It was funny. It was serious. It was just a little combination of everything. Talking about the people who impacted you, your professor, Dr. Clay Jones, he's as an apologetics fan, I'm a big fan of Dr. Jones, but he gave you an assignment early on to talk with a skeptical person about the history surrounding the resurrection. And you had to kind of lay out a case for the resurrection against someone who didn't believe. And so, you actually accomplished this with your flute instructor at the time, who was working with you or playing alongside you. And then her husband happened to be a professor of philosophy who was also an atheist. I was reading through this, and then, not long after that, you become friends with David Wood, who was an ex-convict at the time and a former Muslim and Nabil Qureshi, and both of these guys are on the front lines defending the faith, and I found myself relating to you, because as much as I study apologetics, the idea of being on the front lines and putting it out there and having these confrontational, heated discussions at times, it's just so intimidating. So what is it like for those listening to go from, I'm just studying apologetics because I want to learn this for myself, to now I'm defending Christianity and I have to do so in a more confrontational way?
Yeah, well, I would say it felt like a huge step. I think I call it feeling like jumping off a cliff. That's the kind of feeling, like, and hoping that there's something down there to catch me. And from this perspective now, in hindsight, it wasn't really such a big thing, but it was something I needed to do in order to know that I could survive actual engagement with opposing points of view. I didn't instantaneously combust and it didn't wreck my life or anything. It was okay. And I compare it to much like the study of a language. It's one thing to say it over and over and over to yourself, but it's very quite different. It's quite different when you try to become engaged in speaking that language to others. So I think it's very exciting and a very fruitful endeavor, because you learn how to have these difficult conversations with people. And that can not just help you, like, and not just in, oh, hey, I'm going to have conversation with people who disagree with me, but by navigating those waters, it helps you in other areas of your life, having hard conversations in other areas as well. Plus, I think for me, that move from studying apologetics to defending Christianity, like in the public square, or even not in the public square, but privately in a more of a public manner, not just inside the family or keeping it to myself, I think that incarnates the apologetic endeavor, if you'll actually use it and put it into practice, right? Taking it out of the realm of theory and joining that theorizing with praxis. So that produces good fruit. So I really hope people will take that next step. But yeah, it does feel kind of like a huge step. You kind of have to do it. Make that step and see what's on the other side. Get through the nerves, go to that next step.
Yeah, I love the little moment. I think it was David Wood who's with you before your first debate, and he tries his best to give you this speech to just motivate you. He says, hey, even the heavyweight boxing champ is nervous before his first fight. And in your mind, you were like, this is not the same thing. This is totally different. But yet you still went out there. And I think what a lot of people do, our fear is, whenever I go to defend Christianity, my mind's going to come up blank. And I know a lot of people ask that question all the time. Well, how do you, get to a point where you're in these conversations, might just be with a family member that disagrees with you, but there's so much information to know, and there's so much out there. You know, how do you avoid running blank or losing your train of thought, even especially when you're nervous or in a confrontational discussion?
Yeah. Well, first of all, framing it that way, you are going to have those moments. You just kind of go blank. I mean, gosh, I've had those moments. It's okay. You're human. So just expect that. But I'll say two things, and I'm hoping to say them well. We'll see. First of all, remember the old show Fear Factor? I don't think it was that long ago. People still remember that, I hope. It was based on facing your fears. So I do think there's merit in pushing through the nerves to see what's on the other side. So practice breeds familiarity, and that the nerves will begin to calm down. So the problem is practice needs to be upkept. You have to keep doing it, or you can become nervous when you get out of practice again. So that's the first thing, is just facing those fears and seeing what happens, taking the risk in Christ to see what happens on the other side, you know. And then secondly, I think there's an unfocused objective going on with people when the nerves get super high. And it seems to me that when I'm most nervous, I'm worried about several things. I'm worried about maybe, will they view me as intelligent? Will the audience like me, whether it's an audience of one or a big audience? Did I answer the question well? You know, and there's all sorts of things that I'm focusing on that are self-focused. They basically come back to, what are others' perception of me? And that's really not why we get into apologetics, right? Is to, you know, into a conversation on beliefs. It's not to buttress our ego, because that's going to fail. So, you know, if we can shift the focus a little bit, if we can shift the focus to the people we're ministering to, what does this audience need to hear from me? How can I best serve the audience or this other person in a debate? How can I serve them? What's the best way to do that? When I do that, I find myself paying more attention to the material and to what I'm trying to communicate, rather than to those nerves that are saying, hey, you look like an idiot. Hey, you didn't answer that well. And, you know, so I think I have to remind myself, I'm not there to be lauded as anything, right? But I'm there to serve those who have given their time to attend to or listen to me. And no matter what those people believe about God, I'm there to serve them. And I think shifting the focus, this is Ken Davis in his Secrets of Dynamic Communication calls it an unfocused objective. So if you can shift the focus back to serving the needs, I think that'll calm you down a little bit.
Yeah, you know, that's good, because as I was reading your story, I didn't gather from the story that you were the most confrontational person you may be, but I didn't gather that. And so reading through that, I was like, I relate to that. You know, I want to have these conversations. I want to defend my faith, but sometimes it can be intimidating to have those, you know, awkward talks, even with loved ones or family members or friends, that you know that it could, you know, cause some unrest between the two of you. You know, I want to go back to, we kind of hit on it at the beginning of the podcast, but you talked about the thing that brought you to faith. You know, and you are from California, that area. It's such a beautiful area. And all, you know, all the beauty that you saw in the world and how it pointed you, I've heard you say, toward the artist, you know, the artist of all this beauty that you see in the world. And I don't know if we have this conversation enough in the church about beauty and how that points to our Creator, and a beauty as an objective thing, not just something that I can interpret the way I want, but as an objective force, beauty. And you talked about two professors. One of them I've had over at HBU. He's a buddy of mine, and that's Phil Tallon. And then John Mark Reynolds as well. Both those professors, they helped you to understand that initial feeling that you had, or that initial inclination that you had to search for the source of the beauty. So I'll let you expound on that a bit, but what is it about beauty that drew you to Christ, and how did these professors in particular aid in that understanding of objective beauty?
Yeah, this is something that's been, you know, sort of new in my life and working through this. So I'm sort of at an introductory level myself, but in thinking through, you know, beauty in the world, the main point, and I said this earlier, but I'm going to go back to, is what is this all for? So I couldn't understand why we humans would create these moments of transcendence, beyond just the mundane activities of the world. We're creating a moment to pull ourselves out of just the mundane. And what were these moments pointing us to? What was it telling us? It was hard to say, like, this isn't pointing us to anything beyond ourselves. This is just a temporary satiation, so we don't think about other things or whatever, this sort of utilitarian purpose. But it seemed that there was more to it. And that's, Phil Tallon was the one at HBU who helped me understand this experience as being drawn to the artistry, to the music or whatever, but I was wanting to push on towards the artist, finding the source behind all of this. So wait, is this all from a universe void of meaning, purpose, and intentionality, and so this is for nothing? Or is there a reason all of this exists, and it's supposed to lift me out of the mundane and push me on to discovering something else? And these two professors really put my experiences into words for me that I lacked. I actually didn't understand that there was a lack of theology of beauty in evangelical churches, which is what I encountered, when I hit the church, and all of a sudden I'm encountering all these experiences that to me seem to be, they're pushing back on my artistry. They're pushing back on beauty in the church. And, they hold a sort of a suspicious view of beauty and a suspicious view of beautiful women, not just of art, but also of art. And so I might even go so far as to say there was some suspicion of beauty itself and what it was good for. So, for example, I had encountered pastors who, though they wouldn't put it this way, this is what they're communicating, that they thought the human female form was basically just for male enjoyment, and that it was quite an objectifying point of view that I hadn't encountered in my youth. And so I first encountered this, that the human female form is this like temptation to men in the church. And I had also encountered people and pastors in the church who thought my artistic expression of the beauty of God's creation, because I used dancers, was either salacious or illicit, because I had female humans, although they were teenagers, dancing on stage. So I need to, explain this just a little bit, and I will in short form, but I had dancers who were in leotards, because that's what dancers wear, full leotard, and they had two sets of skirts from waist to floor, because I knew I was dealing with conservative church, so I wanted to be respectful. And these dancers in a dance that I put together, they were representing the creation of the universe as given by John 1:1. And they started in this like folded position. They unwrapped to reveal a light, which represented the light of creation. And one pastor's response to this was, he called them slutty. He said that dancers were slutty. My expression of the beauty of God's creation was compared to a woman of multiple casual sexual partners. And I did not,
wow.
I didn't know what to do with that. I realized I had nothing in common with that point of view. So upon sharing these experiences with these two gentlemen, Phil Tallon and Dr. Reynolds as well. Dr. Tallon and Dr. Reynolds. It helped me to uncover some of the issues that the modern evangelical church has had in its relationship to the objective beauty of God. Ultimately, it seems that the churches that I experienced had adopted a secular influence view that says that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, or relativistic. And so this is why I was getting this, that beauty was something that needed to be controlled, or that it could be a temptation, or because they hadn't adopted this view that there's an objective beauty of God. So they had objective goodness in the church. So we teach there's right and wrong, and there's objective truth. So there's truth and falsity. But when it comes to beauty, there's no objective beauty. So female form, instead of pointing reflection of God's creation, like reflection of his beauty, instead it was being relegated to a utilitarian purpose, like satiating the male or for the male's pleasure. And so therefore it needed to be controlled and viewed with suspicion. And that really was disappointing to me, because there was no teaching on beauty in the church. So that, not just the higher level, but then it trickled down into how we view women in the church. And I thought that was really, again, heartbreaking. I would say heartbreaking is what it was to me, because I had never encountered that until I got into the church.
Right. You know, just reading your story, I was blown away at some of the things, and that, you know, readers really need to pick up the book because these stories are fascinating. They really show you some insight of a perspective of coming into the church and being new to the church and seeing how, I guess, the focus is so just off sometimes. We prioritize the wrong things and we miss these great things that actually led people to us in the first place. I mean, as a person who felt this call or saw something beautiful in the world, that was your initial, the thing that's inspired your walk with God. And then, of course, you come in and the very thing that drew you to Christ is attacked, and now you're having to reconcile that. And I was pretty impressed with the way that you were able to separate the two and say, okay, I can trust the Creator. I know that people are flawed, and still pursue good things and still pursue godly things. But it wasn't an easy journey, and I think that was one of the refreshing things about the book is you're pretty forward with, hey, I'm still working through some of this. There are still things that I'm trying to kind of process through. Every single one of us, if you've been in the church long enough, you've probably been hurt by someone. And so that leads me to another question too. It's, what would you say to someone who has been wounded, and experienced that? Is this something that you are still working through? And what does that look like for you? How do you manage the wounds that you experienced early on in your walk with God?
Yeah, I would say, what does it look like that I'm working through, and am I still working through it? I'm definitely still working through these issues. I don't have like a 10 easy steps to getting through your past hurt, because I don't think someone simply gets over past hurts. It takes a lot of healing and ministering to you from God. Sometimes it'll take your whole life to get there. And sometimes I don't know that we ever, we get fully over things. And there's a great vision of that in a or representation of that in The Lord of the Rings with Frodo's wound that had never fully heals. But there's so many things that I read from Paul and Jesus in the scriptures that are helping me, like forgiveness. We say it, but I have to constantly remind myself to forgive as I've been forgiven. I've been forgiven quite a bit. And so I need to remind myself to do that, trying to work out what that looks like in situations with others, or especially in situations where others are not going to participate in reconciliation, but rather they're going to wall up in their vices. Well, what do I do in that situation where somebody's not going to change and they don't want reconciliation because they think they're right in everything? So, there's working through that. And in those kind of circumstances, one of the teachings from Jesus that I found really helpful is the Luke 6 passage from the Sermon on the Mount, where he tells us to do good to those who don't do good to us in return. This is the love your enemies passage, but if we remember love your enemies, but then he says, do good to those who persecute you, right? Basically, do good to those who aren't doing good to you. And he actually says, what good is it if you just do good to those who return good to you, right? That's even the sinners do that. So he says, do unto others as you want them to do unto you. And I think, that passage, he's not just talking about your enemies of state or people who disagree with your religious beliefs. He's talking about everybody. So people in the church as well. So he knows we're going to consistently encounter those who do not do good. So he tells us, you do good to them. So what does that look like in praxis, and how am I working it out in my life? Well, I'm not gossiping about my gossips. I'm not giving knee-jerk reactions to my knee-jerk reactionists. I'm making up words there, but I'm not returning anger for anger as much as I can. And I'm not making assumptions about those who make assumptions about me. I'm trying. I'm really trying not to do that. And that's the tough stuff. I try to imagine, and I say this in the book, not in this way, but I imagine I'd be better off without this community of hypocrites. Like, oh, life would just be so much easier. And then I remember, I am one of those hypocrites. So what am I even saying? What's it like without them? So, and I also remember that Jesus died for all of us. So if he thought we were worth it, without being trite, I mean, I really suppose I can figure out ways to engage in the church, even when she behaves so poorly at sometimes, you have to be thoughtful about it. Of course, if you've experienced abuse or something like that, there's time to get away and get healing. And mine wasn't the case of abuse, but it was sort of maybe an emotional abuse or spiritual abuse, some of these things were, and you have to learn to deal rightly with them. I sort of call it Gandalfing the situation for you Lord of the Rings fans. I try to think of it as Gandalf is going to do what's right in the world, and he knows everybody's going to fail him. He's just going to keep on being the great pilgrim and do what's right. And it's hard and it's lonely at times. It's very lonely.
Yeah.
But again, Jesus died for us. So I'm still figuring it out myself.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned Lord of the Rings a couple of times, and you talk in the book about how you felt like a tree beard. And so people who are Lord of the Rings fans can relate to that. You said, you know, you quoted Treebeard, said, I'm on nobody's side because nobody's on my side. And, you know, for someone who is, you know, in a lonely place in the church, there's been that sense, you know, in my own personal life, for example, there's been times where I feel like maybe the church didn't understand me, or, you know, there's so many people that can relate to that, especially people who study apologetics and come into their church and say, hey guys, let's have these tough conversations, and then find out that nobody wants to hear about that, or nobody wants to go down the rabbit hole of philosophy, or, you know, I hate that we have pushback against that, but people experience this. So I wonder what you would encourage someone who feels lonely, maybe in their own church or where they're at. How should they find community? I mean, you were very fortunate to find some of the people that you found, and you know, and in my own life, I've been fortunate to find some people at HBU that I really connected with. But what would you say to those out there who were feeling like tree beards, and how could they find community?
Yeah, I love that you picked up on this, on this one little, it makes its way into the dedication as well as the book. And it's not a big section, but yeah, it's in there because that's really, truly what it feels like sometimes. Like, you know, that you don't agree with the atheist, but you don't find Christians who are matching up with how you do your Christian walk. So you feel very lonely. And I really think to, you know, for people listening, I would say not to give up on looking for those people because they do exist. Like you've said, you found it in community at HBU. And, you know, just keep looking for the people with similar interests. And what I would say is it might not be a church group. Oh, no. Yeah. You know, it might not be. There may be other people outside your church group who like to dig through difficult issues. And C.S. Lewis once said that, you know, where we have a common question, we have a friend. You know, the people who care about the same kinds of things we care about, we have a friend in them. And he said we don't have to have the same answer. So ideally, I would like for it to be people in the church. I would like to find those people. But I've struggled to find them. And I do typically find some. Remember, I have a limited experience. So my experience has been in a certain kind of church, in a certain denomination. And, you know, sometimes it just took time for me. I had to mature to be able to see who those people were in the church. So a couple of ideas would be to pray for those people. That's not a bad desire to want to be in community. So I would definitely pray for that. But also be willing to look in the broader Christian community. So if you're not finding those Christians in your neck of the woods, you know, your denomination, they might be congregating elsewhere. So maybe it is time to stop pushing on the church and trying to push something that's not happening. Maybe it's time that you do seek out a different community of believers, or even, you know, different culture. Maybe your people aren't the Northerners or the Southerner, you know, maybe if you're in the South, maybe your people are actually some of the people up in the North, or vice versa, or something, or the West Coast or the East Coast. Maybe it's time to try a different culture as well. I know that sounds like, hey, yeah, I mean, I wish I could get up and move and go somewhere, but just be cognizant that you may be dealing with a cultural issue sometimes, and maybe you're just not jiving with the culture. Right. So there are people out there. Pray and look for them. Ask God that you would be attuned to who those people are.
Yeah. You know, I have two questions, but I could probably put them into one too. You talk about this concerning void that you found in atheism, and, you know, it's one of your chapters, a concerning void, but I think that was a really unique thing in the fact that you were able to compartmentalize two things. You know, one, here's how Christians are behaving, and two, here's the message of Christianity. Here's what's true, and versus an atheistic worldview that doesn't really capture the truth of our existence. So in atheism, there's sort of this existential problem. We're here, but what does it amount to if we're all just here by a big cosmic accident and then we're all just going to die one day and that's it? You know, but Christianity is a unique story in itself. So I wonder if you could expound on the concerning void that you had with atheism and what you found uniquely in Christianity that sets it apart and that fulfills that void.
Yeah, that was one of the driving forces in the book is when you see, look at these deconversion stories, people are talking about how they just are leaving Christianity, but they don't tell you in their story what they're going to. So what worldview are you adopting? Mm-hmm. So if you're leaving Christianity and you're saying, well, I'm adopting atheism, to me, one of the roadblocks to leaving Christianity was atheism because of the atheist worldview, because there are so many things that I found lacking in its philosophical framework. So as an example, when you look at that, I have this quote from Richard Dawkins, which sort of typifies Bertrand Russell and this sort of thinking, which is that basically, in a universe blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect. If there is a bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. And he says, DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. So if his very deterministic assessment here is accurate, then I believe it would be the same. Like all of this would be true in an authentically atheist philosophical framework. There's no good. There's no evil. In fact, there's no purpose or intentionality. You're just dancing to the music of your DNA. But there's something very deeply disturbing about that when you put that up against thinking about the human experience. And it's that it betrays a complete hopelessness. It's a complete hopelessness. He's saying the world is just the way it is, and we should expect it to be this way. So if that's true, it means that whatever defects we have, they're hardwired in our DNA. So there's no, as Julian Baggini of The Guardian says, there's no redemption. There's no forgiveness. There's no second chances. And he says our lives can go horribly wrong in ways that can never be put right. And yet, we have the minds to think about these things for years of our lives, right? This is the angst of a purposeless universe. We got stuck here in a randomly evolved, with the randomly evolved ability to think about meaning, purpose, and value in a universe in which there is at base none to be found. So we're stuck here thinking there's a way things should be, a right or wrong, in a universe in which none of those things exist. So we live our lives in this sort of delusion of thought and emotion, and then with a cruel sense of indifference, the physical forces of the universe cause the effect of our deaths. I mean, this is really hopeless. And Christianity, on the other hand, states that the universe and everything in it was created with purpose and intention. So there is a rhyme and reason to why things happen. There's a real good and evil. And things have gone horribly wrong, but we are not left to suffer indefinitely and indiscriminately as faceless cosmic orphans. Rather, it was God had original creation that was good. What he made, he said, was of good value. In fact, he made us in his own image. So when things went horribly astray from that original intention, God already knew it was of good value, so he redeems it. So he redeems his originally good creation and restores it to the right relationship with the creator. And this gives us hope. And that's something that we have in our human experience. We believe that there is a real thing called hope, that the way things are not how they always have to be, that our pain and suffering has meaning, has value. And you can clearly see this in the Christian framework of Jesus's death and resurrection. So the meaning, the purpose, and the value to human lives that I found in Christianity more accurately and effectively explain my human experience.
Yeah, I think it's so, so good what you say there, and I love that chapter because I think we need to we're always on the defense as Christians, but you also have to think about the fact that atheists have some things to explain too. I mean, this whole illusion that we have of hope, of beauty, of love, of values, of, you know, we hold people accountable in a court of law for doing things that we're also told by atheists was just, they were just dancing to the music of their DNA. And so how do we do that? How do we even, you know, build a society with an atheistic framework? It's so difficult for me to wrap my mind around that. You know, I'm always, as a Christian, told I have just blind faith. But I think it takes so much more faith to just say, well, this is all an illusion. What you feel, that hope, that connectedness to beauty that you felt that brought you to Christ, that was just an illusion. That was something that, you know, your brain waves were telling you. But it's not real. There's nothing transcendent about it. There's nothing that points to a higher order or creator. You know, it takes a lot of faith to believe that. So, you know, I love the book. I love what you put in there about how, you know, even on an atheistic framework, there's not a lot of hope on their framework. And even on a Christian framework, there are some questions we will have that go unanswered. But there's much more answers in the Christian worldview. It accounts for way more than the atheistic worldview. And there's hope there. And I think that's what we're feeling and that sense of belonging that we're feeling. I want to thank you for coming on. I really have enjoyed this talk, and I love the book. But for my listeners that are tuning in, where can they find you and where can they find the book if they're interested in getting a copy?
Oh, well, you can find me at maryjosharp.com. And you can also click through my website to Amazon, or you can go straight to Amazon and you can find my book there or at any of the Christian book retailers, even at Barnes and Noble. You can also find me in the fully online apologetics degree program at Houston Baptist University, where I teach several courses. So would love to have you join me for a degree in apologetics as well.
All right. Yeah, there you have it. So get you a copy of the book. It's a great book. It's a great book for people who are just interested in starting apologetics. It's something to share, too, with people who have been wounded by the church in the past. If you have a friend or family member that's had some issues, I think this would be a great book to call back some people who maybe walked away a long time ago. Put this in their hands and see what happens. So go out and get a copy of the book. Thanks again for coming on. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you for hosting me. I just keep working with diligence. People go high, be vigilant. Because people go lie and say that they're real. And then you cold-blooded like chameleons. Keep it 100, I keep it a billion. Long as it's God, it's knowing as real as it's known as real. Evil go pillage through all of the villages. Like as you valleys, don't stop in Leviticus. I feel like Joseph, he prayed in his